Chapter 6. To Ronan Barthes. How the apotheosis of individual expression is reduced to a discourse of desolate abandonment. Sherlock Holmes, The Adventure of the Dancing Man. "No doubt," I said, "of course." I had picked up the original cipher message and was now bending my brows over it. "It's a pretty maddening to think that an important secret may lie here on this slip of paper, and that it is beyond human power to penetrate it." Sherlock Holmes pushed away his untasted breakfast and lit the unsavory pipe which was his companion in his deepest meditations. "I wonder," said he, leaning back and staring at the ceiling, "perhaps there are points which have escaped our Machiavellian intellect. Let us consider the problem in the light of pure reason. This man's reverence is to a book. It is our point of departure." "It is indeed a case of Machiavellian intellect to presume that the core of individual body perception, whether or not it contains a core, or unity of the sensorium, whether or not it contains a unity, could be decoded as a text. By now it seems that the mysteries concerning individual body perception have been, and always will be, the point of departure in all sciences. To unravel the true nature of human beings, the individual body has been stinked, pricked, dissected, abstracted, visualized, inscribed, but most importantly, objectified. The secret has failed to disclose its being, and the result is exclusion of perception for the sake of a linguistic expressionability. Individual body expression is the subject which has no object, no way of convincing the world of its existence. In the process of scientific production, in which the product, hence the object, is so decisive, this has led to suspicion and doubt wherever individual expression is concerned. The contempt, the reduction to genre or general thinking, is the inevitable result of such continuous doubting. Contempt is the modern replica of the plague of killer bees. The bees, next to the birds as icons of fertility, economize eroticism, multiply desire in the modernistic sense, and leave the individual body in the midst of contempt. In many spurious attempts that follow the work of Foucault, the individual body has become a mere shadow of its own existence. It has become both focus and locus of a panopticum that eyes its eye with contempt. In its line of development there exists a stream of concepts circulating like little prison cells around the center of a rather arbitrary or economic attention. Self, identity, performance, image, I am this, I am that, I am nor this or that, I am myself, I express myself, I for me, I think. All of these are predicates needed to convince the other that it is just me who speaks. Superiority relies on the rational self, as opposed to the conscious self. Awareness, awakening, enlightenment are the linguistic signs of individual existence. Their representation is, of course, never real and therefore always the source of conflict concerning the higher enlightened, the higher awakened, the higher aware self-consciousness. The process itself always is restrained by shame, guilt, and contempt, from the outside secluded through exclusion and isolationism. Individualism should not create childish little fesses to think of themselves exclusively, yet the system of economic liberation needs to uphold the might of individualism, not it, but exclusively this type of individualism. As it seems, the topic of individual body perception and expression is suspect on the one hand and dilettante or obstinate to say the least on the other hand. Predicates, names, and categories are incapable to battle the reoccurring desolateness of the individual body, and this is what Roland Barthes realized after a long quest of semiotic wanderings. His legacy contains a bundle of writings which, ironically, express the persistent boundaries of individual needs as being met by language and writing. In the early days, Roland Barthes was considered in Europe as one of the most important representatives of French structuralism. Two of his major works, Elements of Semiology and The Fashion System, indeed might be viewed as attempts to structuralize semiology. In fact, Elements of Semiology is a complete review of courses in general linguistic by Ferdinand de Saussure for the sake of designing a science of semiology. He adopted, sometimes quite literally, de Saussure's linguistic concepts concerning the incapacities of individuals to modify speech, as well as the arbitrary nature of the sign. However, in adopting concepts from Ferdinand de Saussure, his quarrel with language would become inevitable. His ideas on individualism, especially the individual body perception and expression, did not coincide with de Saussure. One of the solutions to this problem, Barthes attempted by modifying de Saussure's theory, changing the relationship between linguistics and semiology. De Saussure looked at linguistics as a part of a greater field of science, semiology. Barthes felt that this placement should be reversed, that is, semiology as part of linguistics. He did not completely explain this reversal, but rather activated it by proposing to view the syntax of language construction as speech events. With this action, Barthes could connect the combinatory freedom of the speech act with the capacities for individuals to modify through momentary choice in expression. This idea on momentary choice of expression basically allowed him to maintain a general idea concerning the binarism, an absolute requirement for his semiological theories, as well as the individual freedom essential to his own physical expression. Proposing semiology as part of linguistic indeed also confronted discourse in itself with the conservative aspects of its forms. The arbitrary, or in Barthes' terms, unmotivated nature of the sign then becomes a responsibility of the linguistic form by which it presents itself, both creating and destroying the freedom of its expression, as well as an infinite expansion of differences which maintained in itself the freedom of creation. Such a freedom of creation is timeless on the condition that one escapes the linear sequence imposed through the historical demands of language. Binarism itself could only pluralize differences, according to Barthes, for that every repetition had to accentuate the difference rather than its reduction to the former binary oppositions. To partly escape time in his autobiography, he therefore resorted to a description of his feeling and views rather than a linear summary of his life, and to maintain the impression of one dealing with a person rather than an authorless text, as well as maintaining the presence of the difference. Barthes' autobiography is written in the third person. He is, rather than I am, and he is more convincing. Through him, the other, he created the object of his love, the difference, as well as the dynamics of eroticism. A citation. For a certain time, he went into raptures over binarism. Binarism became for him a kind of erotic object. This idea seemed to him inexhaustible. He could never exploit it enough. That one might say everything with only one difference produced a kind of joy to him, a continuous astonishment. As a result, the capacity for change through differentiation turned Ferdinand de Saussure's premises upside down. De Saussure viewed the time factor as an inescapable limitation for individual modification. The evolution of languages does not ensure the conservation of individual speech modification. Barthes viewed exactly this capacity of language as a precondition for change, and found that, because the concept of a conservative duration in language is imaginary, as all semiosis, it enables freedom. The tension between individual difference and language structure would maintain the most dominating topic throughout his entire life and work. As I remarked earlier in this book, much of it was explained by the fact that Barthes was a homosexual, and he is therefore considered to be one of the co-constructants of what is called gay discourse. Barthes himself, however, resisted this interpretation on the same grounds as he resisted the generality in language. It was not his place to belong to any category, and he viewed it as a monstrosity that established a pigeonhole, as he wrote. Pigeonholed, I am pigeonholed, assigned to an intellectual site, to a residence in a castle, if not a class, against which there is one internal doctrine, that of atopia, of a drifting habitation, atopia superior for utopia. Utopia is reactive, tactical, literacy, it proceeds from meaning and governs it. This atopia is exemplary in Barthes' works. It exceeds categories in as far as Barthes tried to disconnect himself from the more pressing genre of his times, modernism. And he succeeded. First of all, he fully subjectified the possibility of a zero degree in writing at the mercy of ideology, leaving no objective claim intact. Secondly, he accentuated the mobility and the dynamics of the individual bodies as drifting habitations, which in itself conveyed process rather than status, static. And finally, he brought the modernist concept of desire into a genuine perspective, that is, into a desire created by society. The discourse of desire for Barthes had little to do with the desired object. Rather, he viewed this lover's discourse as a result of a long and continuous process by which individuals could do not but express absolute abandonment. Indeed, his book, The Lover's Discourse, has little to do with the ontology of love, attraction, or erotics. Instead, it conveys how unanswered love, unaffirmed love, is met by a judgment of obsession and resulting exclusion from the same discourse. Here, the individual stands fully isolated in the faith of mankind, and language indeed becomes the site for affirmation. The beauty of Roland Barthes' work should not be searched for in the claims that various groups tend to have for internalizing him in the discourse of their likings. It does not matter whether this entails politics, psychology, semiology, or sexuality. Barthes opposed it as a restraint of freedom, explaining his place, his milieu, is language. That is what he accepts or rejects. That is where his body can or cannot. To sacrifice his life as language to political discourse? The beauty of his work, therefore, is rather represented by sheer ugliness of individual isolation. Barthes' approach to the work of De Sade, Fourier, and Loyola reveals the marriage of such isolation, as it leads to absolute unique conjectures of speech. The elements of the hidden concepts underlying discursive consolidation, in fact, signify a semiotic space in which the nature of individual expression becomes the act of ultimate binarism. If in the reality language is nothing, then it follows that individual expression creates its existence not by being of a linguistic nature. The mystery of individual expression continues because it is mystery. The ideological justification of language indeed is as much the justification of an unaffirmed love as utopia itself. Where Ferdinand de Saussure constructed the idea that in order to study a language act, one needs to have at least two speakers, Roland Barthes maintained the idea that in order to study a language act, one needs to have at least one person in love. The structure of language as well as the linguistics create such a drama of unique individual perception. The consequences of such an individual outcome signify for Barthes his ideal of relationship. He did not seek out an exclusive relationship, possession, jealousy, scenes. Nor did he seek out a generalized communal relationship. What he wanted was, each time, a privileged relationship, marked by a perceptible difference, brought to the condition of a kind of absolute singular affective infliction, like that of a voice with an incomparable timbre. And, paradoxically, he saw no obstacle to multiplying this privileged relationship. Nothing but privileges, in short, the sphere of friendship was thus populated by dual relations. Hence, a great waste of time. He had to see his friends one at a time, resistance to the group, to the circle, to the crowd. What was wanted was a plural equality, without indifference. Though Barthes is quite unique in his views, the appearance of the individual scene, I feel, stems from the empty halls of old times. Similar cries for plural equality of difference can be found throughout the history of Europe and the United States, as we know by now. These cries have been interjected by Goethe, Kandinsky, Rousseau, Pound, Whitman, Sapir, and by many others. Barthes frequently resorts to Sorensen Kierkegaard as a Christian example of resistance against the generality of language, suggesting too that this resistance is as much pre-capitalistic as it is capitalistic or post-capitalistic. This, in spite of his reverence to time wasted, as an uneconomic result of the need for dual relationships. Curious, within the French literary tradition it seems that individual expression has reached its apotheosis. It seems almost as if the French philosophers have invented the concept of desire, as well as the destruction through eroticism, one of those philosophers no doubt being Georges Bataille. Also, within the French tradition, individual expression in some way seems to finally feminize itself without resorting to a genre or to feminism. Such an unique example is the work of the French novelist Marguerite Duras. Both she and Barthes crossed the boundaries of their time, as they seem to leave modernism behind at the peak of its bloom. It almost seems self-evident that the philosophical developments in France are the result of a very old French revolution, which seemingly dominated the whole of Europe. It is easy to resort to Rousseau, Diderot, and Voltaire as the actors of the body images of both the bourgeois and the individual ideal. It is for the same reason very easy to reduce or disperse of these images as belonging to an old-fashioned lost cause, which the French Revolution has become since the writings of Marx, as well as its supposed revolution thereafter. Reduction of authors like Rousseau, Diderot, and Voltaire would nevertheless render ignorance about modernism itself and keep Western philosophy a prisoner of its own Indo-European language tradition. More important, it would signify ongoing contempt where individual body expression and individual body perception is concerned. Much more than anything else, the Indo-European language tradition consists of modeling the world. Not only does it entail structuralism, it completes the evolutionist process which was created by structuralism in the first place. And behold, structuralism was to France what Darwinism was to the evolutionistic revolution in Great Britain, the father of functionalism. Structuralism in France prevented revolutions to ever occur again, hence left only the personal revolution, for which in the end we might be grateful, if we were able to survive the desolateness and the contempt. as well as the fascist dangers caused by this contempt. Writing is part of such process as much as fighting with writing, but a paper tiger, as well as a paper revolution, shows only the surface. Neither for Roland Barthes nor for Marguerite Duras could it stand for all, and this in itself might be writing's proper place in society, an evocation of our being in the world, a reminder perhaps, but never a model of culture für sich or a culture an sich, and not ever a group idea. Maybe as such we could break the endless game of mirroring between the sacred and the profane images of the texts. In the writing of Roland Barthes and Marguerite Duras, the twain have met. As neither one of them cannot and refuse to be located within a single frame, their texts are the true masters of the mystery surrounding individual bodies. As Barthes seemed to have spelled gay discourse, Marguerite Duras, too, has been threatened to fall incorporated in feminist discourse. This might partly be the result of their mysterious character. Still, their aim would seem more evocative, or, as Willis writes on Duras' work, if these texts flagrantly toy with a detective model and then fail to produce, to disclose the corpse, the killer, or the scene of the crime, they then present a radical interrogation of the limits and the underpinnings of the investigative economy. What they give instead is a circulation of positions so unstable as to subvert the narrative frame, the movement from ignorance to disclosure. Barthes as well as Duras toyed with the positioning of the I, now using he, then she. In this sense, they made a clear distinction between the I and its object, the other's I. The other's I being both the condemnation through categories, and the I being the other's inexpressionable pain. Marguerite Duras, one could say, wrote photography, and Barthes, one might say, photographed writing. This letter to Roland Barthes, therefore, is an act of solidarity, not in terms of consensus, but against contempt for individual expression. So, very dear Roland Barthes.